Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, the year 2020 marks the centennial of the 19th Amendment, guaranteeing women the constitutional right to vote. After the passage of the 19th Amendment, remember, 100 years ago, women then demanded full equality by proposing the Equal Rights Amendment. Would you believe that still is not part of the Constitution? Well, Julie Sook is my guest today, and she has a fascinating and very timely new book, We the Women, the Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment, looks at the journey and the persistence of many brilliant women throughout American history who fought for women's rights. Julie shares their stories and challenges, and today we explore why the Equal Rights Amendment still matters, why it still isn't part of the Constitution, and we look at some of the amazing women who've kept pushing the Equal Rights Amendment forward. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Julie Sook is a frequent media commentator on legal issues affecting women. She's been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CBS News. She's a professor of sociology, political science, and liberal studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, where she also serves as dean for master's programs. In addition, she's a visiting professor of law at Yale Law School and has taught at several schools of law, including Harvard and Columbia. And again, the book we're talking about today is We the Women, the Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Act. And here's my guest, Julie Sook. So We the Women is such a timely book and extremely enlightening. I'm so glad to have you with us today, Julie Sook. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
And 2020, amongst other things, marks the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which of course guarantees women the constitutional right to vote. And that was followed by the Equal Rights Amendment. And your question when you're writing the book was, have we come far enough? So let's begin with why you wrote the book. And I read you hadn't really given much thought to the Equal Rights Amendment until, I think it was 2013, when you were a panelist on Law Day at the American Bar Association. So what changed on that day for you?
Well, you mentioned, Vicki, that the Equal Rights Amendment was introduced immediately after women won a very long struggle for the right to vote. And that happened in 1920, and they introduced another amendment that would have guaranteed women equal rights in all domains, not only the vote. And but unfortunately, that struggle is continuing even on to today, because that Equal Rights Amendment, which was introduced in 1923, was not adopted by Congress until the 1970s, and was not ratified by enough states to make it a constitutional amendment until recently this year. And even now, there are some questions that remain about whether or not it's too late to add it to the U.S. Constitution. So the reason things changed for me in thinking about the Equal Rights Amendment in 2013 was not that 2013 was a particularly significant year. Really, what happened is that when the ERA was not ratified in the 1970s, people generally forgot about it in the 80s and 90s. And all the way up until, really, until 2017, people just thought it had its day. We didn't get enough state ratification, so it was no longer an active possibility that women should contemplate. And for me, the reason I had a wake-up was not only because I was invited to participate in an ABA panel about equality under the U.S. Constitution for women, but also because I had spent so many years since graduating from law school and becoming a law professor thinking about constitutional equality amendments for women around the world. That is, a constitutional guarantee of equal rights between women and men is a very common feature of constitutions in really almost any country that wrote a constitution in the 20th century,
right.
Certainly after World War II. And so because I had spent all my time studying these other constitutions, I began to ask myself, why don't we have the ERA? What should we make of the story of failure in the United States? Does it say something weird about the U.S. Constitution that we don't have a guarantee of equal rights for women?
It certainly raises a ton of questions. It certainly did from my perspective. First of all, I mean, this may sound really ignorant. Obviously, I didn't grow up here. I didn't move to America till my 20s. But I've always interpreted we the people at the start of the Constitution as meaning me, including you and including every other woman in America, to read your book and find out, no, that's not true. So I guess my question is why the ERA, they did give the Equal Rights Amendment a deadline. It had to become fully ratified within a deadline. But, you know, why the deadline and why are they being so weird about it now in not moving this forward?
Well, the deadline is an interesting thing because in the United States Constitution, we have a rule for adopting amendments. And that rule says that you need 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the state legislatures. And interestingly, that's a very huge majority. And if you're starting to introduce that amendment around the time that women are just getting the right to vote, there have been very few women in Congress. Even today, we're at an all-time high of 23.7% women in Congress. If you think about that and think about our constitutional rule that says you need 2/3 of Congress, if you have 23.7% women in Congress, that's definitely not enough to adopt a constitutional amendment. It's not even enough women to block a constitutional amendment because you'd need 1/3 of Congress to block a constitutional amendment. So I think it's important to think about the numbers, and that's just because of what our Constitution says about how you get an amendment done. And generally, the 7-year deadline, that's something that was invented in the 20th century. We never had deadlines on constitutional amendments before, but it was invented by the opponents of the Prohibition Amendment, which was introduced in, well, it was introduced in the late 19th century, but by the time it succeeded, it was 1917, 1918, 1919. And then it went into effect. And that was an amendment over which there was quite a lot of division in the country before it finally came to pass. So the 7-year deadline came to be a tool of political opponents where they could use something that looks procedural, like a deadline, and not take the political heat for opposing the thing that's being proposed. And I think that's what, but unfortunately, what happened with the deadline is that it became a normal part of constitutional amendment making in the United States. So with a lot of amendments, not all amendments, and very importantly, the 19th Amendment did not have a deadline. But many of the amendments did have deadlines. And so originally, when the ERA first got a huge overwhelming majority of the vote in the House of Representatives in 1970, really 50 years ago now, that version of the ERA did not have a deadline. But what happened was that then the Senate would not pass the ERA that same year. The opponents in the Senate, there weren't very many opponents, but the men who were really against the ERA in the Senate were very vocal and very powerful. And they said, why doesn't this thing have a deadline? And they used a procedural argument. Why doesn't it have a deadline to change the amendment? And what that meant in practice, if you change the amendment after one house has already passed it, it means that it dies. It goes to the legislative graveyard. So even though, I mean, it would have been poetic to get an ERA in 1970 as women were celebrating the 50th anniversary of their right to vote, but instead the guys in the Senate sent it to the legislative graveyard, and the women proponents of the ERA had to reintroduce it in 1971. And when they did, Martha Griffiths, who was the fierce proponent in the House of Representatives, she just decided that she wanted to quiet some of the most vocal opponents, and so she added the deadline to the version that was introduced in 1971. She believed that there was so much support for the ERA that even with the deadline, it would pass and it would get ratified within 7 years.
Right, and so we know it didn't. So I guess the big question now is it still important to get this on the table?
Well, it certainly is very important, but it's important for different reasons. than the reasons why women wanted it in 1920, and it's different from the reasons why the framers of the ERA in 1970 wanted it, because both the law and gender relations in American society, if not in the whole world, have changed significantly in 50 and 100 years. So I think that the ERA still has an important role to play, but it's a little bit different from what was initially envisioned, if you'd like to talk more about that.
Yeah, definitely. I'd like to just take a moment, though, to look at some of the women who were the early pioneers. Who are some of the women that we don't hear about that really made a significant difference? Because I'm looking through your book, and one of my favorite parts, Julie, is where you have the photographs through the history of all of these women who've been change makers. And there are a lot of them, and it really puts a face to their stories. Do you have a favorite story? Do you have a favorite challenge that somebody overcame?
So one of my favorite figures in the book, and she's someone that we're talking about a lot because she lived such a long life and worked on so many causes, but the Equal Rights Amendment was also one of her causes, Mary Church Terrell. She was an African-American woman who was actually born in the South before the Civil War even ended. And so she was born into slavery, basically. But then she grew up as a free person and went to Oberlin College and studied classics and studied European history and eventually traveled to France, Germany, and Italy and became fluent in all of these European languages. And so she was extremely worldly, and she was extremely engaged with developments in women's rights and the women's peace movement in many other countries. And I think that really had an effect on the way that she thought about both racial equality and racial justice and gender equality, and particularly the struggle of African American women. One of the most amazing stories about her is that in 1904, she went to a huge International Women's Council conference in Berlin and delivered a speech about the status of African American women in German. And she talked about the National Association of Colored Women, an organization that she founded, and all of the work they were doing. And what's so interesting is that she was a racial justice person. She worked on anti-lynching, and later on in life, in the mid-20th century, she was also a very important figure in fighting against racial segregation in the United States. But at the turn of the century, one of the women's issues she was really focused on, in addition to the right to vote, was establishing day nurseries and kindergartens, because she knew that the reality on the ground was that some women actually had to work, especially African-American women and working-class women. They had to work. They didn't really have a choice. And in order for them to work and to be able to lead a minimally decent life, they needed childcare. And that was an important insight that comes through in some of her early speeches at the very beginning of the 20th century. And what's really amazing is that we're sitting here in 2020 in the midst of a global pandemic where women still don't really have access to affordable and high-quality childcare, and the pandemic has made that even worse. And we know that when you don't have infrastructures that support childcare, any promise of equality for women is going to be somewhat empty, and it's going to fall short.
Yes, and you write in the book, you talk about how the ERA falls short in providing several things, especially for women. One of the ways that they tried to squash this was by pointing at those mothers and telling them it would be bad for motherhood, bad for mothers. I mean, talk about laying on the guilt, because, you know, there are guilt trips coming at working mothers all the time, right?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the most widely accepted explanations for why the ERA did not get the 38 ratifications needed, it came really close. It got 35 ratifications before the deadline in the 1970s and 1980s. And one of the explanations for that was that there was a very powerful Stop ERA movement led by women, actually, and specifically Phyllis Schlafly, who was extremely charismatic, became a conservative icon in the United States. And she argued that the ERA would destroy the American family and that it would be terrible for mothers and especially women who chose to stay home and raise their children. And what she said about the Equal Rights Amendment was not necessarily true, because in the Congress when Congresswoman Martha Griffiths, who is a Democrat, she supported the ERA and pushed it forward. She had the support of her Republican female colleagues, including women like Margaret Heckler and Florence Dwyer, who were in the House of Representatives with her. And they all argued that the reason the ERA was needed was to help mothers and homemakers achieve equality. That is, there were many inequalities that women faced because of their traditional role in childbearing and child rearing. And if you think about it, the entire history of women's disadvantage and inequality is really tied up in some way with the assumption that women's proper role is in the home. And so they thought that the Equal Rights Amendment, by getting rid of certain barriers to opportunity and by getting rid of certain discriminations in law, they would actually make it possible for women who increasingly had to work to support their families and would make it possible for them to be economically independent while also being mothers. So it's really very unfortunate that the debate got so confused in the 1970s and 1980s, where people began to believe that the ERA would actually be bad for mothers, when in fact, so much of the argument in favor of the ERA was about inequalities women faced because they were mothers and trying to do something about that.
Yeah, there was a lot of shuffling around of roles. I mean, in the mid-century there, because after during World War II, women had to go out to work in factories and fill jobs that you know men would have been taking if they weren't overseas fighting a war, and many of the women wanted to continue working after the war. But when the men came back, things started changing again, and there was the resentment came in about they're taking jobs from women. And I remember, even as a child in the 60s and 70s, that was an argument that I heard sometimes in the media, that women are taking jobs from men. So it's like we can't win for losing in some respects there. I want to just talk about this. I read an interview with journalist Lynn Scher. She said that one of the most unappealing parts of this whole thing was white Southern women, mostly in the early 1900s, worried that giving the vote to women would enable too many black women to vote and cancel out the white vote. And she said that led some of the suffragists to say some things and do things that were politically expedient, but of course racist. And the way that they tried to get Southern states to ratify was to assure them that their votes would cancel out whatever black votes that there were, essentially, in her opinion, setting up Jim Crow for the future. Do you agree on that? Is that something you came across in your research?
Yes, so there's no denying that throughout the history of the suffrage movement from the 19th century until the ratification of the 19th Amendment, some of the white suffragists did make certain political compromises. They were concerned that in order to get a constitutional amendment, they would have to get several southern states to agree. And that's just a fact about the really difficult rule that the U.S. Constitution has. You need three-fourths of the state legislatures. And I should add that right now, before we got the three states, if you look at the 12 states that haven't ratified, most of them are states in the South of the Equal Rights Amendment today.
Right, right.
So now going back 100 years, a lot of the white suffragists really played into what it took to get white Southerners who were racist and who really feared the political power of black people, and particularly black women, they pandered into that kind of racism and fear of African-American power in this country. But I think that said, there were also a lot of coalitions that were made. I mean, we have to understand that the suffrage movement in the United States, I mean, it took a lot of interesting turns, not all of which we're proud of, but really it originates with women who are involved in the abolition movement.
Right.
Or anti-slavery advocates.
Right.
And so they really saw an analogy between slavery and the subordination of women in marriage. And so I think that's also an important, and there were coalitions that were made between white women and African-American women. Susan B. Anthony and Carrie Chapman Catt worked with Mary Church Terrell. Mary Church Terrell joined the National Woman's Party and picketed the White House with Alice Paul, even though she later admitted that she believed that Alice Paul would have just traded away the African-American woman's vote if she could get the white woman's vote that way. So it's very complicated.
It is. I was going to say, it's a very complex journey. It's nowhere near as simple as it's portrayed. I'm wondering, I know you're a scholar in this field, but what jumped out at you that surprised you the most or shocked you the most when you were doing research for this, which I have to say is impeccably researched?
Oh, well, thank you so much. There were so many surprises for me. I think one was I actually did not know very much about Patsy Takemoto Mink. She was elected to the House of Representatives in 1964, and she was the first non-white woman to be elected to Congress at all. And she was a Japanese-American woman from Hawaii who had grown up during a time when her Japanese-American fellow members of the Japanese-American community were interned by the U.S. government because the U.S. government was at war with Japan. And so she lived through that. She also lived through going to university and being told that she couldn't live in the same dorm with many of her white classmates because she was considered a foreigner and a person of color. So she really struggled through that, but she wins a seat in Congress, and she becomes a fierce advocate for women's rights. And today, she is known as the mother of Title IX. Title IX is the statute that guarantees equal educational opportunity, and she was a very important mover of that legislation. And in fact, very recently, after she passed away in 2002, many years later, the Title IX was actually renamed the Patsy T. Mink Educational Opportunity Act. So I think she has gotten recognized for the work she did for gender equality after her death. But she was someone who was also working along with another woman of color, Shirley Chisholm, who was the first African-American woman elected to Congress shortly after Patsy Mink was. And they both worked in the late 1960s and the early 1970s on child care legislation, the Comprehensive Child Development Act. It was a piece of legislation which, had it passed, would have created child care centers for pre-kindergarten and younger for all Americans, regardless of their ability to pay. We could have had a real child care infrastructure in 1970, but unfortunately, after all that work that some of these amazing women in the House of Representatives did to get tremendous bipartisan support in both houses of Congress, unfortunately, President Nixon vetoed the act, and we've never gotten the momentum back to come as close as we were 50 years ago to having a real child care policy in this country.
It's really shocking to me. It's just shocking. I was, when I was reading the book, I was kept gasping at certain parts of it.
Dear.
You know, but I think, you know, because I see myself as an independent woman, I never really thought too much about the Equal Rights Amendment and what it meant and the struggles that we've gone through to get this. And yet, legally, according to the Constitution, we're still not there, you know. So that's what's so shocking to me. But one of the stories that I loved was right at the beginning of the book, John Adams' wife, Abigail Adams, who wrote him a letter in 1776 and said, "Remember the ladies." And then she went on to say, "All men would be tyrants if they could. But if particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." And I love that story because it was written in 1776, you know, we're still here having the same conversation. But it's a reminder, I think, that how we raise our sons is important because, you know, we're fighting the good, if you will, but, you know, men have to move with us, right?
Yes, absolutely. So, of course, I didn't include in the book John Adams' response. He kind of laughed at the suggestion that ladies should be remembered in the new code of laws that he was about to participate in making. And what I find most remarkable, and that quote from the letter is something that's not not only in that letter, but it gets quoted again and again when women lawmakers in Congress and in state legislatures bring up the ERA. So that voice has gotten amplified so many times because at different moments in history, not only when she wrote it in 1776, but all the way leading up to Virginia's ratification of the ERA in 2020, they keep quoting those words from that letter. And so what I find really amazing about those words also is that she says that they're going to foment a rebellion if they don't have voice or representation in the making of the laws. And remember, this is 1776, mm-hmm. The beginning of the American Revolution.
Right.
And the men who were taking up arms, engaging in violent conflict on the grounds that they did not accept a government in which they were not represented.
Right.
And it's really the same argument that she's making.
Exactly. I think
that's... We're not represented.
Exactly.
How could we be bound by the laws? If we're not part of lawmaking, how could we be bound by anything you tell us to do? How could that be legitimate? And but of course, women didn't have rights. Women didn't have the vote, and they certainly didn't have guns. And so the rebellion that she is talking about is a different kind of rebellion. It's not a violent revolution that just takes a few years.
Mm-hmm.
It actually takes generations, takes over two centuries.
Yeah.
And it's women building, they keep quoting her. And,
yeah.
And the women who keep quoting her then die, and new women keep quoting her and the women who came before. And I think that's very much the story of women's rights in this country. It's not a revolution. It's a rebellion that lasts across generations.
So moving forward, what do we need to do? What do we need to be aware of to move this forward? Because it makes sense to me as a common laywoman, if you will, that it should be in the Constitution. You know, because at any given point, we could have those rights taken away from us if it's not in the Constitution. You say hot buttons we should pay attention to are pregnancy discrimination, sexual discrimination, unequal pay. We talked about working mothers and people of color. What do we really need to be aware of, and how can we make change?
Well, I'm going to say two things. The first thing is that one thing that we have to understand about the amazing women who fought for the ERA was that they were kind of successful, even though we don't have the ERA formally added to the Constitution as of this very moment. The women did use their movement for the ERA, really dating from the 20s and certainly in the 70s up until the present. They used that momentum to change other laws, not constitutional law necessarily. The Constitution also changed in that we have a general equal protection clause that the Supreme Court started to interpret starting in the 1970s to include a ban on sex discrimination. But I think when we look at that history, some people say that that's evidence that we don't actually need the ERA anymore because women have all these rights already. And my take on it is that it's exactly why we need the ERA. I mean, if women are going to do all this work, why not give them credit for the work that they've done? Why not make legitimate all the changes that they've already made and worked so hard for? And I think that's the most important argument
Yes.
for the Equal Rights Amendment now. And then the second thing I want to say is more of a practical nature. There was this deadline, and the deadline was 7 years from 1972. So that's 1979. And before 1979 came along, though, we were still three states short of the required 38 states. So in 1978, Congress actually voted to extend the deadline once, and they extended it to 1982, but no additional states ratified by then. But the fact that they extended it once really proved that Congress actually has the power to change the deadline. If you think about deadlines in ordinary life, it's really rare that a deadline means you actually turn into a pumpkin. A deadline means
Right.
you might miss it, and if you miss it, the person who imposed the deadline really has to decide what to do. And that's exactly the situation we're in right now. Congress imposed the deadline, and now Congress already decided once to extend the deadline. It can decide to remove the deadline altogether. And the good news is that the House of Representatives actually did that. They voted in February to remove the deadline and to recognize the ERA as validly ratified now that Virginia has become the 38th and final state to ratify it.
Okay.
But the problem is that the Senate has not moved on it. There are 48 senators who have sponsored the proposed resolution to remove the ERA deadline, but Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is personally not a supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment, and there are others in the Senate who are not interested in the ERA and therefore not interested in removing the deadline. So I think that if people really care about removing the deadline and getting it added to the Constitution, they can be vocal about it, because this is an election year where many Senate seats are up for grabs, and it's possible to change the composition of the Senate and maintain the composition of the House so that on the next go around, that ERA deadline gets removed.
It is unbelievable in the 21st century that we have a majority leader who opposes equal rights. It's just unbelievable. You know, Julie, I love that you write in the acknowledgements. You practice what you preach, because you write in the acknowledgement, "My greatest debt is to my outstanding husband, who remained calm and loving while doing the lion's share of absolutely everything at home while you wrote this book." So,
yes, absolutely. And that is also so important. I mean, the book is called We the Women, but it's really a project about the American people and the American Constitution. And in order to have true gender equality, doing something that will remove certain disadvantages that women have faced because of childbearing and childrearing will benefit all of us. I mean, there are burdens and joys to childbearing and childrearing, and it just needs to be more evenly distributed. And I think that's one of the most important things that public policy can help us with in order to achieve gender equality, which is going to be to the benefit not only of women, but to men and children and people of all genders.
Well, great information. Well-written book, really superbly researched. I thank you for being with us, Julie Sook. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, the final thought I want to leave the listeners with has to do with Shirley Chisholm's quote, which I think has been in the press a lot. She once said, she was the first African-American woman elected to Congress, and she said, "If they don't give you a seat at the table, bring in a folding chair." And that was her philosophy. And I want to say that these women really did that. They brought in their folding chairs, but you know what? I think it's time to get some real chairs.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what this amendment is about. You know, women brought in the folding chairs. They did all kinds of things to make sure that even without the amendment, we would still get closer to equality. But I think it really is time to upgrade those chairs.
Absolutely. And so then the we the people will then really mean we the people, not just we the men. Julie Sook, the book is called We the Women, The Unstoppable Mothers of Equal Rights Amendment. Do you have a website for the book?
So my website is juliecsook.com.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, Julie, for being with us. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Vicky. It's been a pleasure.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.